This episode discusses a case involving domestic abuse and may be disturbing for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. ...23-year-old Brooklyn native Nancy Argentino had plans for her future, but all of that changed when she met and fell for a world-famous professional wrestler, Jimmy Superfly Snuka. Nancy went on the road with Snuka, operating both as his girlfriend and business associate, and while things may have begun well, they quickly turned bad. After a violent incident requiring police involvement in January of 1983, Nancy's family begged her to come home, but she refused to press charges and went back on the road with Snuka. 4 months later, in May of 1983, the Argentino family received a call in the middle of the night. Nancy was dead, the result of complications following head injuries. Despite a pathologist report suggesting homicide, more than seven different explanations from Snuka himself about what happened that night, and the insistence of the Argentino family, Snuka walked free. 30 years later, Snuka would be charged, but found incompetent to stand trial. He would die shortly thereafter, taking the truth with him. Did Jimmy Superfly Snuka murder Nancy Argentino, or was it an accident like he later claimed? Why did it take more than 30 years to charge Snuka, and what role, if any, did Snuka's celebrity status play in the investigation into Nancy's death? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 83, The Death of Nancy Argentino. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the highly controversial death of Nancy Argentino. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focusing on a different unsolved case each week. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at @TraceEvPod, on Instagram at @TraceEvidencePodcast, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. You can visit the website at trace-evidence.com for full episodes, social media links, merchandise, and more. As a final note, Trace Evidence is a complete one-man operation, so if you'd like to help support the podcast, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/traceevidence, where you can gain rewards such as stickers, pins, and other surprises. If Patreon isn't your thing, but you still want to pitch in, there is a PayPal donation button on the website. As a final note, I'll be taking off next week since I'll be in Chicago this weekend for the True Crime Podcast Festival, so if you're attending, I look forward to seeing you there. Episode 84 will release on Monday, July 22nd. Also, stick around at the end of today's episode for details regarding a contest that could make you a part of Trace Evidence. Today, we examine the circumstances surrounding the untimely death of Nancy Argentino. It's a complicated case with a lot of controversy. This is Episode 83, The Death of Nancy Argentino. Nancy Lorraine Argentino was born on March 30th, 1960 in Brooklyn, New York, to parents Caroline and Ralph Argentino. Nancy would have two siblings, both sisters, Lorraine, who was 6 years her senior, and Louise, who would come along later. Growing up in Brooklyn in the 1960s provided an eclectic and diverse community with many different cultures coming together, though between the 1960s and today, that diversity has only grown more. Nancy grew up in the 800 block of North 27th Street. Her parents were working class and did their best to maintain the home and put food on the table, which, according to the sisters, they did exceedingly well. The Argentino family were Christians, Catholic to be specific, and while in the 1960s that may have provided a more strict upbringing, there certainly was no shortage of care and love inside the family home. From an early age, it was clear Nancy was sharp, free-spirited, and charming. Nancy possessed a charisma that was undeniable, and according to her sister Lorraine, quote, She had a fun spirit. She didn't have any trouble relating to people. People were drawn to her. She was just fun to be around. End quote. Nancy didn't have any issues making friends and was able to connect with people in a way which made them feel that she truly cared, because she did. According to Lorraine, she had a special bond with her little sister, and it was often she who was there to provide support and offer advice when Nancy sought it out. Later in her life, when she'd find herself in exceptionally difficult and painful situations, it would typically be Lorraine's phone that would ring in the middle of the night. As Nancy grew older, her intelligence was developing quickly, and according to her family, they had high hopes for what it was she might achieve in life. Lorraine has mentioned in the past that while Nancy was not a materialistic person, she did appreciate the finer things in life and wanted to be comfortable. How many children who grow up in a working-class family don't seek to attain and provide more than they'd had the opportunity for? When Nancy entered her teens, it was the mid-1970s and the country was in the midst of a cultural shift. The more buckled-down tones of the 50s had been usurped by the revolutionary protests of the 60s, which spilled into the post-Vietnam War era to the mid to late 70s. By 1975, the 15-year-old had grown into an attractive young woman who was drawing looks from men and certainly had her share of suitors. Her sister, Louise, would later state, quote, "You have a look and an attitude, I think, when you're raised in Brooklyn. She was tall, she was pretty, she took good care of herself." End quote. While most who knew Nancy at the time described her as beautiful, both inside and out, her interest appeared to lie elsewhere. It was at the age of 15 that Nancy began working in a dentist's office and began looking towards a career as a dental assistant. Following her graduation from high school, Nancy would go on to attend Brooklyn Community College, where she'd follow her career path, registering in several courses that could help to further her plans. But a chance invitation from a close friend would forever change the course of her future and open the door to a world which Nancy had previously ignored but would find herself drawn into. That was the world of professional wrestling, and it was through her connections to friends that she would not only be taken into the wrestling world, but also the lifestyle. And soon, she'd have left behind her former plans for a life lived in hotels with travel bouncing her all over the Northeast. But she wouldn't be alone. In 1982, 22-year-old Nancy would go on a date with a man named Terry, who would later go on to rule the professional wrestling world under his ring name, Hulk Hogan. While this date didn't lead to a relationship or much beyond a few drinks, it was another in a series of events which would propel the young woman deeper into a world she may not have fully understood. While Hogan's destiny would produce a boom in the industry just a few years down the road, there was a man who was arguably already sitting high atop the business, and Nancy, with her magnetic personality and undeniable attractiveness, would go on to catch his eye. His real name is James Wiley Smith, later James Ryer, but you may know him as Jimmy Superfly Snuka. Born in May of 1943 in Fiji, Snuka had been wrestling around the world since the late 1960s when he'd come to the conclusion that there was more money to be made in wrestling than he was making at the time as a professional bodybuilder. Snuka had earned prestigious titles, Mr. Hawaii, Mr. Waikiki, Mr. North Shore, with his driven work ethic and impressive physique. But the future for a professional bodybuilder didn't seem to offer the same opportunities that Snuka craved. For the next decade and a half, Snuka would wrestle from coast to coast in the United States, which at the time was divided into different territories owned and operated by different wrestling companies. This was a very different environment from the one which exists today, where arguably the United States and much of the world knows only of the WWE. Vince McMahon Jr., CEO of WWE, worked hard throughout the 1980s to boost his own territory after buying out his father. Over the course of the next decade, off successes like Hulk Hogan and WrestleMania, McMahon would buy out or push out of business many of the other territories. In 1982, McMahon had the slightest glimmer of a dream he'd call WrestleMania, which would launch in 1985. But prior to making such an expensive and risky move, he wanted to establish a new image for the then World Wrestling Federation. Part of that initiative happened in January of 82 when McMahon signed rising star Jimmy Superfly Snuka. At the time, Snuka was a married man with children at home. The life of a wrestler then, much as now, involves a lot of travel, with higher-ranked wrestlers, like Snuka, being on the road as many as 300 days a year. The then WWF operated predominantly out of the Northeast, with the company's business headquarters being in Stamford, Connecticut, though the true heart of the organization was in New York. And to the wrestlers on the card, there was no better place to ply their craft than in Madison Square Garden. Nancy, who had been going to the shows more often, began attending wrestling events fairly regularly at the Garden, and it was inevitable that she and Snuka would cross paths. Snuka was struck by Nancy, 16 years his junior, standing 5 feet 7 inches tall and weighing 115 pounds, her dark hair framing her bronze skin and dark eyes. She appeared quite petite next to the muscular shape of Snuka's 5 feet 10 inches and 235 pounds. Pictures of the couple together frequently show the disparity in size, with Snuka dwarfing Nancy. Despite the complexities involved, the budding relationship between the two would grow, and it didn't take very long for both to be infatuated with one another. Snuka did have a wife at home, though it was not uncommon then, and for anyone who follows the business to this day, to see a wrestler acquire a mistress, or a multitude of them based on their particular location. Frequently traveling around the country, though based more so in the Northeast, many wrestlers had girlfriends and mistresses in various areas around the country. In his own memoir, Snuka defined Nancy as his East Coast girlfriend. The details surrounding Nancy's knowledge of Snuka's marriage are a bit difficult to ascertain. There are those who have argued that Nancy was unaware of Snuka's family and believed that the two were going to get married someday and have a life together. According to the Argentino family, Nancy brought Snuka home with her on several occasions, and for the most part, he was perceived as a decent man. Nancy's mother described Snuka as a good man, though somewhat quiet and withdrawn. Lorraine was less accepting. In an interview with the Morning Call, Lorraine would explain, quote, "I really couldn't figure out what the attraction was. She was pretty, and she had a great personality, and he was weird. He never spoke. He used to come over to the house, and he wouldn't say one word," end quote. According to Nancy's mother, Caroline, Nancy believed that Snuka loved her and that they were going to have a future together. Caroline would later describe Nancy's perspective as taking their time and seeing what developed. She knew her daughter had discussed the possibility of an engagement with Snuka and that the couple had plans to move into a condo together. Furthermore, several members of the Argentino family report having been present on an occasion, at which time Snuka presented Nancy with a ring and publicly declared his love for her in front of her relatives. Despite this outward expression of affection, the family did begin to grow suspicious, and soon it was being discussed that maybe the reason the relationship between Nancy and Snuka seemed to not be evolving was that the wrestler may be married. Some, who have given comment over the years, suspect that Nancy may have known about Snuka's family, but that she believed he planned to leave his wife, or perhaps the wrestler had convinced her that that was the case. Their relationship, while romantic and intimate, also began evolving into a business situation. Snuka had a reputation for being a volatile person to deal with, who lived by his own rules and wasn't exactly a great employee. He was frequently angry, difficult to deal with, and was late to events more than he was on time. This may have been due, in part, to Snuka's overindulgence with alcohol and drugs, namely cocaine. Nancy stepped in as a sort of manager/assistant/secretary, taking on more of the business side of Snuka's life and making arrangements for hotels, travel, and whatever was necessary to keep Snuka on the ball, working, arriving on time, and overall, happy. The latter part may have been far more complicated than Nancy had imagined. As part of their business arrangement, and certainly in connection to their romantic relationship, Nancy began traveling with Snuka. Rather than being in New York and driving or taking mass transportation to meet him in towns or at events, Nancy and Snuka became traveling companions, driving long distances between towns, staying in hotels and motels, eating together, working together, spending their nights together. It wasn't long before those close to Nancy began to notice that something had changed, and the previously caring relationship between the two had grown more volatile, with Snooka's anger coming out more frequently, and Nancy herself being the victim of first verbal assaults and later physical abuse. Snooka would later deny that he'd ever laid a violent hand on Nancy, let alone any woman, but evidence exists to the contrary. Snooka's first wife, Sharon, would later acknowledge that Snooka had been physically abusive with her for years. Buddy Rogers, a former pro wrestler who lived in Snooka's neighborhood, later told a reporter, quote, "Jimmy used to beat the shit out of that woman. She would show up at our house bruised and battered, but she couldn't leave him. He had her hooked on the same junk he was using," end quote. Snooka later claimed that he didn't get Sharon hooked, but that they had been using drugs together. Sharon was, however, at least once hospitalized due to injuries sustained from Snooka. The relationship between Sharon and Snooka would eventually deteriorate further, with them divorcing in 1999, though in the years that passed, Sharon refused to speak much about her former husband. She did, though, remain a part of his life, and towards the end of his life, they were reported to have been on good terms. Another example of the contradiction took place on January 18, 1983. The town of Salina, New York, sits in central Onondaga County. At approximately 1:40 a.m., the Onondaga County Sheriff's Department received a call from the Howard Johnson Motor Lodge. The call, placed by the on-duty manager, came after multiple calls came into the front desk to report a loud and violent dispute taking place in room number one between a male and a female. Reportedly, one guest had complained that the occupants of the room were raising hell and a male was beating up a female. According to Lorraine, earlier that day, she had received a call from her sister complaining that she and Snooka had gotten into a fight and she wanted to come home. By the time the sheriff's deputies arrived on scene, it had grown extremely violent. It's been reported that the first thing deputies experienced was a completely naked Snooka and Argentino wrapped up only in a sheet, exchanging loud words outside of their room. According to officers on the scene, Nancy was shouting that she wanted to get away from Snooka and go home. In one officer's report, he specified that once Nancy noticed the police presence, she tried to flee, but Snooka reached out and grabbed a handful of her hair, pulling her back, grinding her face against the wall, before throwing her back into the room. As officers approached and asked Snooka to step outside, he slammed the door in their faces, locked it, and then pressed his body up against the door to brace it while shouting loudly that he had no interest in speaking to the police and they needed to go away. While Snooka and deputies exchanged words through the door, Nancy's screams could be heard outside, and it's been reported that she was begging for help and screaming that she wanted to get away from Snooka and be let out of the room, but Snooka wouldn't budge. At this time, officers tried to open the door but couldn't get through, and so they radioed for backup and more deputies arrived at the motel. After arguing with Snooka more and demanding that he open the door or be subject to arrest, Snooka still refused, and so a group of deputies managed to finally force the door open, but that was only the beginning of their struggle. Snooka stood in the doorframe, blocking entry to the room, and the large, muscular man threatened the police to back off. At that time, a deputy tried to force his way into the room, which resulted in Snooka pushing and pinning him to the wall. While Snooka held one officer against the wall, another came up behind him and, utilizing his nightstick, locked in a chokehold. Snooka was surprised and reached up to grab the nightstick from his throat, at which time the deputy, who had been pinned to the wall, was freed. He managed to snap one ring of his handcuffs on one of Snooka's wrists, but the second cuff would not come as easily. According to the report, it took several minutes for a total of 9 sheriff's deputies and 2 police dogs to successfully subdue Snooka and position his other wrist and secure the cuff. Once Snooka was cuffed and brought down to the floor, he continued to scream, argue, and resist to the best of his abilities. Officers at the time were able to get to Nancy, while others instructed Snooka to get dressed. Snooka, however, refused, and by one way or another, Officers managed to get him to put on his underwear, but he would not get fully dressed. He continued to resist until he was dragged from his room, across the parking lot, and finally deposited into the back of a patrol vehicle. Nancy was taken to the hospital for examination while Snuka was driven down to the station for processing. According to one officer's report, Nancy's injuries consisted of a bruised right thumb, possibly fractured ribs, an injury to the lower back, and a contusion on her neck. There were also reports afterwards that Nancy had to be treated for injuries to her scalp due to Snuka's violent pulling of her hair. When asked about the incident, Nancy explained that she and Snuka had attended a wrestling event in the town of Elmira, and upon their arrival at the hotel, Snuka began speaking about the truth of God. Snuka reportedly became enraged when he felt Nancy wasn't paying attention to what he had to say. It was at that time that Snuka began screaming and became violent with Nancy. Snuka was ultimately charged with third-degree assault, second-degree attempted assault, resisting arrest, and obstruction. He was locked into the county jail and bail was set at $5,000. Snuka would later address the incident in his memoir, though his statements about what occurred stand in stark contrast to the reports of officers and witnesses who had been present. According to Snuka, he had spent some time drinking and smoking marijuana with some of his friends earlier in the night. He went on to allege that police, along with canine units, burst into his motel room that night and began assaulting him. Snuka claimed to have never fought back, nor to have placed his hands on Nancy. Snuka claimed that Nancy was fine, he did not assault her, and he was not holding her in the room against her will. In an interview with the Toronto Star just a few weeks after his arrest, Snuka stated, quote, "The hotel manager just got a little excited. Yeah, there was some excitement. The cops just didn't give me a chance to explain. They blew it up." End quote. 3 months later, in April of 83, Snuka was set to go to court in connection with these charges. However, Nancy gave a sworn deposition that Snuka had not struck her nor intentionally harmed her. The district attorney of Onondaga County dropped the charges in exchange for Snuka pleading guilty to harassment. In total, Snuka received a one-year conditional discharge, apologized to the sheriff's office, and donated $1,500 to the Ronald McDonald House charity. The entire incident, as horrifying and disturbing as it is, was handled extremely cavalierly by the media. It did become a national story, but the story seemed more about Snuka's battle with police than what had happened to Nancy. This violent incident has been described by some as not the first, and certainly not the last time that Snuka would become physically abusive with Nancy, though the more time passed, the more aggressive and volatile he would behave. Nancy's sister once alleged that Snuka had threatened her, saying, quote, "I could kick you and put my hands around your throat and nobody would know," end quote. The entire situation in Salina, New York took place just 4 months prior to Nancy Argentino's death, which would bear striking similarities. According to Lorraine, following the terrible incident in Salina, Nancy returned to her family home. During this time, she was obviously upset, physically injured, and emotionally drained. Her family, concerned for her safety and well-being, tried their hardest to convince the 23-year-old not to return to the road with Snuka and to stay home and try to move on with her life. In an interview with the Daily Beast, Lorraine explained, quote, "My mom told her, 'Listen, Nancy, you're too pretty and too smart to put up with this. You have to think about this and get out of this relationship.' But it was too late. Nothing we could do," end quote. Nancy did return to life on the road with Snuka. On May 8th, Mother's Day, she placed a call home. She was traveling with Snuka from Connecticut to Pennsylvania and planned to stop by and visit with her family. Nancy never arrived, and this was the last conversation she'd ever have with her mother. On May 10th, 1983, Snuka was scheduled to appear at a TV taping for the WWF in Allentown, Pennsylvania. According to Snuka, he and Nancy had gotten a room at the George Washington Motor Lodge in the town of Whitehall, just outside of Allentown. Snuka claims that Nancy wasn't feeling well, and so he planned to head to the show alone, leaving Nancy behind in room 427. Snuka alleges that he kissed Nancy goodbye and told her that he'd return after his match. Snuka arrived on time, geared up and wrestled a match against Jose Estrada, which he was scheduled to win. Reportedly, Snuka had plans after the match to return to the motel where he was going to sit down and share a few drinks with fellow wrestlers Don Morocco and Mr. Fuji. Fuji and Morocco would later tell authorities that, after a few drinks, Snuka told them he wanted to go back to his room and check on Nancy, who he described as not feeling well. When Snuka arrived, he claims to have found Nancy on the floor, barely breathing, with yellow mucus pouring from her nose and mouth. It was at this time that Snuka claims to have called 911 and asked for an ambulance. Paramedics arrived on the scene and found Nancy lying in bed, naked, with only a sheet covering her. Her breathing was weak, her pupils were dilated, but her heart was beating quickly. This is typically a sign indicating trauma to the head. When EMTs asked Snuka what had happened, his first response was that earlier in the day, he'd gotten into an argument with Nancy, shoved her, and she'd fallen and banged her head on the concrete. This will be the first of no less than 7 explanations Snuka would provide over the years. However, by the time a police officer arrived just minutes later, Snuka's story adjusted slightly, this time alleging that the two were fooling around outside the room and Nancy had slipped and banged her head. Nancy was immediately rushed to Allentown's Sacred Heart Medical Center. According to 2 women working in the emergency room that night, Snuka accompanied Nancy into the room, and when he was asked what had happened, he said that he'd pushed Nancy and she'd fallen back and hit her head. Another story was given to Dr. John Fassel, who was working in the emergency room that night. According to the doctor, Snuka told him that the two were messing around, play wrestling, and that Nancy had fallen and struck her head. Snuka, at the time, allegedly claimed that Nancy recovered and they continued to wrestle around a bit more and that she seemed to be physically in good condition. Later, Snuka will tell a hospital chaplain that on the way to Allentown, they had stopped on the side of the road so that Nancy could relieve herself. Snuka claimed that, while returning, she and Snuka were fooling around and he'd accidentally pushed her a little too hard, at which time she'd fallen and banged her head on the pavement. Snuka's differing accounts will continue on through several more people, and his final statement, the one to which he will adhere for the rest of his life, won't be given until the next day. He will later allege that, despite telling more than 5 individuals that he had shoved Nancy, that they'd misunderstood what he was saying. Nancy arrived at Sacred Heart Medical Center at approximately 12:40 a.m. on May 11th. Less than 2 hours later, Nancy Argentino was pronounced dead at 1:50 a.m. She had never regained consciousness. While not exactly an official declaration, hospital bills later list the main factor leading to Nancy's injuries as an altercation. Other reports specify her death as due to the result of undetermined craniocerebral injuries. Reportedly, it was Snuka, along with the hospital chaplain, who would make the call to Nancy's family, informing them of her passing. Lorraine later recalled her mother on the phone, seemingly completely shocked and repeatedly saying, "She's dead." Later on in the morning of May 11th, at approximately 9 a.m., Snuka sat down for an official interview with investigators in the same room he'd shared with Nancy. The transcript of the interview includes Snuka's account of what occurred and reads, in part, quote, "On the way here, we stopped on the side of the road to use the bathroom. She was desperate to use the bathroom, so she went into the bushes and squatted. In the meantime, there were a lot of trucks coming by, so I said to hurry up, and she jumped across the grass onto the road, and then she slipped and fell backwards and hit her head, right on the concrete, on the side of the road. She just slipped backwards. I'm pretty sure this happened on Route 22 coming down. We were already in Pennsylvania. She had a real bad concussion. When I saw that, I just picked her up and slapped her across the face to get her to come to again. I had to pick her up. She was unconscious. This happened early in the morning, about 4:30 or 5 o'clock. It was not quite light yet. We drove right here, and when we got here, she said she was having a little pain in the head, and I told her to come and lay down." End quote. Snuka goes on to explain that the next morning she wasn't feeling well. He went and got her something to eat. He then left at approximately 1 p.m. to go wrestle, returning at 6 p.m. According to Snuka, when he checked on her at 6, she was breathing, sleeping, and seemed to be in some pain. He says he wet a towel, loaded it up with ice, and placed the compress on her head. He then left again to wrestle for the TV taping at approximately 8:50 p.m. Snuka went on to allege that he returned and found Nancy unresponsive, and he tried to get her to wake up and speak with him. When he finally realized something was seriously wrong, he contacted the front desk and asked them to call 911. He also addressed bruises and scratches on her back, claiming that this was partially due to her slip on the road and also due to his attempt to pick her up. Snuka's official account of how Nancy was injured was different from the stories he'd been giving in the immediate aftermath. It was also very much in conflict with the autopsy as conducted by Dr. Isidore Mialakis. In summary, Dr. Mialakis wrote, quote, "After review of the history and complete autopsy of the body of Miss Nancy Argentino, death is attributed to craniocerebral injuries, the pattern of which is consistent with a moving head striking a stationary object, but is not consistent with a single simple fall in view of the multitudinous other scalp, facial, and bodily bruises and abrasions. The multiplicity and magnitude of the injuries may even be suggestive of mate abuse." End quote. Mate abuse is apparently how domestic violence was described in 1983. Dr. Mialakis went on to explain that he examined the clothing Nancy was wearing when Snuka alleged that she had fallen on the side of the road and wrote that he could, quote, "find no evidence of dirt or tears of the fabric. They were subsequently submitted for criminalistic evaluation. The hair and scalp were also examined at the time of the autopsy, and no gravel or other similar dirt particles were noted." End quote. In terms of the hours leading up to Nancy's death, Dr. Mialakis, in conjunction with a neuropathologist, determined that Nancy had likely been unconscious for approximately 12 hours leading up to her death, and, quote, "the terminal aspirational bronchopneumonia is consistent with an unconscious state. In view of the autopsy findings and the discrepancies in the clinical history, I believe that the case should be investigated as a homicide until proven otherwise," end quote. Lehigh County Deputy Coroner Wayne Schneider later stated, quote, "upon viewing the body and speaking to the pathologist, I immediately suspected foul play and so notified the district attorney," end quote. I should note, the autopsy report also addresses more than 24 cuts and bruises found on Nancy's body, including injuries to her head, ear, chin, arms, hands, back, buttocks, legs, and feet, which Mialakis also stated were consistent with mate abuse. Over the course of the rest of the month of May, detectives and the district attorney were quiet about the investigation, though the Whitehall Township Police Department did list Snuka as a person of interest. On May 27th, District Attorney William Platt spoke publicly for the first time since Nancy's death and explained that the investigation was nearly complete, and they were now waiting to bring everyone together, attorneys and investigators, to finalize the details. Just 5 days later, on June 1st, the case would officially go cold, following a second interview with Snuka, though this time it was not just a few officers and Jimmy Snuka. Attending this interview was District Attorney Platt, Assistant District Attorney Robert Steinberg, Dr. Mialakis, Whitehall Police Department Detectives Jerry Procannon, Al Fitzinger, and Vincent Geiger. Snuka arrived, but he didn't come alone either. Vince McMahon, the CEO of the WWF, also attended, with a briefcase in hand. There is no record or transcript of what was said that day, though Assistant District Attorney Steinberg later commented that Snuka was fairly quiet while McMahon did most of the talking. Snuka himself later claimed to not remember much about the meeting. McMahon's presence that day, over the years, has become a major source of speculation, with some, even Snuka himself, later insinuating that money may have changed hands. The WWF later issued a statement about this, calling it, quote, "absurd, categorically false, and insulting to all parties," end quote. Given all of the information available, one of the questions that has lingered since June 1st, 1983, is why was Jimmy Snuka not charged in connection with Nancy's death? The answer to that question, as frustrating as it may be, is different depending on who you ask. Overall, the common response is that there simply wasn't enough evidence. District Attorney Platt is alleged to have felt that if he brought the case before a jury, he would lose due to there being holes in the evidence. Dr. Mialakis would later say, quote, "The clear-cut forensics weren't there, but the suspicion was there. I did not have a clear-cut case. It was a very worrisome case. Obviously, there was enough there to arouse my suspicion, but not enough to take it to trial," end quote. District Attorney Platt would go on to become a judge, and when asked about why charges were not filed and his overall thoughts of the case, he responded by saying, quote, "I am prohibited by the Code of Judicial Ethics from discussing cases publicly," end quote. Perhaps as a sign of the times and how domestic violence was treated in 1983, one investigator was quoted as saying that just because Snuka had beaten Nancy in the past did not mean that he had beaten her to death. In hopes of ensuring that charges were filed and that Snuka would be prosecuted, the Argentino family hired Richard Cushing, a New York attorney, who was asked to examine the evidence and speak with District Attorney Platt in hopes of getting the ball rolling. Cushing examined all evidence, spoke to witnesses, visited the scene of the crime, and in his opinion, found enough evidence to file charges, but the DA disagreed. In an interview with the Morning Call, Cushing stated, quote, "I was stonewalled at every turn. It became clear pretty soon that he had no intention of presenting the evidence that I amassed. All the pieces were there. There was enough to take it before a grand jury in 1983. I could not understand why the district attorney could not see it," end quote. Cushing would later speculate that Platt may have been intimidated by Snuka, McMahon, or both. For the Argentino family, it was devastating. They believed that Snuka had murdered Nancy, but were also beginning to recognize that charges were not going to be filed. Lorraine later expressed that Cushing had done a good job and worked hard for them, but he simply couldn't get the DA or anyone to push harder for charges. At the time, they were overwhelmed with trying to process what had happened to Nancy, and following Cushing's explanation that he didn't believe Snuka would be charged, they all deflated. Lorraine later expressed that, dealing with the loss of Nancy and the emotional toll it took on all of them, and then the information that Snuka wouldn't be charged, forced them to withdraw. While they loved Nancy and wanted justice for her, it became incredibly painful for them to discuss publicly or even privately, and as a result, they may have allowed things to slide by that they normally would not have. In Snuka's memoir, he discussed attending Nancy's funeral. Snuka would write, quote, "At the funeral, I told her mother and father how sorry I was about her death. What else could I possibly say?" End quote. Several witnesses reported hearing Snuka commenting on how horrible Nancy looked. The mortician had been unable to completely conceal her injuries. Moments later, Snuka was seen exiting the funeral home, remarking that he would return later for the church service. Lorraine, however, remembers things very differently, explaining, quote, "He came in there with shorts and didn't say anything to my mother. He did not express his apologies or sympathies," end quote. Snuka would go on with his life, touring with the WWF, partying, becoming an even bigger name in the industry than he had before. For the most part, any discussion of Snuka's possible involvement in Nancy's death was that of backstage whispers or speculation amongst groups of wrestling fans. In an effort to try and gain some level of retribution against Snuka, the Argentino family filed a civil suit against him in 1985. The suit accused Snuka of intentional and reckless and negligent and careless behavior, which may have included pushing or shoving Nancy either on Route 22 or at the George Washington Motor Lodge, effectively causing the injuries that led to her death. Snuka responded with an affidavit in which he claimed to be broke, alleging that he owed $75,000 in back taxes, and Snuka's attorneys even dropped him as a client due to his inability to pay them. Snuka also included in the affidavit, quote, "I know the Argentinos feel grief for their loss, and I know they want to be comforted. They were my friends, and I hope they will find a way to show mercy on me and not take advantage of my present situation and my inability to defend their lawsuit," end quote. The Argentino family was granted a judgment in the amount of $500,000, though they would never receive a single penny of that money from Snuka. Following the civil suit, the Argentino family fell out of the spotlight. Together, they struggled to accept the loss of Nancy and what they viewed ultimately as a failure of the law to bring them justice. Caroline kept Nancy's room exactly as her daughter had left it for many years following her death. Over the course of the next 30-plus years, the family would speak of Nancy and how her death had affected them, what their lives might have been like had she lived. Nancy's father, Ralph, passed away in 1999, never seeing justice for the death of his daughter. Lorraine later stated, quote, "I always felt so guilty because I felt that at that moment when she was in trouble and she got injured, I always felt that if she could have gotten to the phone, I would be the one who would have gotten that call from her." End quote. There would be no news in regard to Nancy's case until June of 2013, some 30 years after her death. Lehigh District Attorney Jim Martin announced that his office was going to take a fresh look at the case to decide if it would be possible to convene a grand jury. By this time, Snuka was 70 years old and had no interest in discussing the case with anyone. Martin said that he had received letters from Nancy's sisters and that, in combination with speaking to one of the sisters, made him decide to take a closer look at the previous investigation. 6 months would pass. But in January of 2014, Martin spoke publicly and announced that the case had been presented to a grand jury. The grand jury was able to review documents connected to the case, including interview transcripts, the medical examiner's report, and even Snuka's own autobiography. I should note that while transcripts are available, a recording of an interview with Snuka went missing over the years, and even the autopsy report was lost for a period of time. The autopsy report was eventually rediscovered, though the tape was not. Snuka also appeared before the grand jury, though he pled the fifth multiple times. His lawyer would argue that this was not to avoid incrimination, but due to the fact that Snuka genuinely couldn't remember, as he was suffering from memory and cognitive issues likely related to the many head injuries he suffered throughout his wrestling career. On September 1st, 2015, 32 years after the death of Nancy Argentino, Jimmy Snuka was officially arrested and charged with third-degree murder and involuntary manslaughter. The official report from the grand jury noted that Snuka had provided more than six different accounts of Nancy's injuries, ranging from physically shoving Nancy to Nancy falling accidentally without his involvement. In a statement from the grand jury, they wrote that Snuka's, quote, "assaultive acts and his failure to obtain medical attention resulted in her death," end quote. When reached for comment, Nancy's sister Louise responded, quote, "I think that it's been a long road. They did the right thing in the face of all the evidence," end quote. Snuka was arraigned on September 1st and was sent to Lehigh County Jail, where his bail was set at $100,000. At the time that he was sent to jail, Snuka was in a wheelchair and attached to a feeding tube after having a large portion of his stomach removed due to cancer. Snuka's ex-wife, Sharon, ultimately paid his bail. Snuka's attorney, William Moore, made multiple statements in regard to the physical and mental state of his client. Moore would later explain, quote, "His faculties are so compromised you wouldn't know what he's saying. He doesn't understand a simple conversation. You put him up against a sharp prosecutor asking, 'Remember 30 years ago when you said this?' He has no recollection," end quote. WWE later spoke to the media, having inducted Snuka into their Hall of Fame class of 1996, and at the time of his arrest in 2015, they had him signed to a Legends contract. Following his arrest, WWE acknowledged that they were suspending Snuka's contract and removing all references to him from their website pending the outcome of the trial. Robert J. Kerwin II, an attorney speaking on behalf of Snuka, told the press that Snuka was not in good health but did look forward to defending himself, as he would, quote, "like to leave this world knowing he's an innocent man, not with everyone thinking he's guilty," end quote. On Monday, November 2nd, 2015, Snuka went before Judge Kelly Bannock to plead not guilty. At this time, Snuka addressed Judge Bannock, expressing that he never went to school, could not read or write English, and was unsure of where he was or what day it was. This resulted in a hearing, scheduled to take place in May of 2016, during which time it would be determined whether or not Snuka was mentally competent to stand trial. Snuka's attorneys argued that Snuka was mentally deteriorating and utilized the statements of a forensic psychologist, Frank Dottillo, who found Snuka incompetent, describing him as a shell of a man who is experiencing dementia, as well as his brain shrinking, which is causing major memory loss. The prosecution, however, provided video of Snuka wrestling the previous year in May of 2015. In the match, Snuka dropped two opponents before climbing to the top rope and performing his signature splash. Prosecutors argued that Snuka never complained of memory loss or head injuries until after he learned he was under investigation. Records indicated that Snuka scheduled an appointment with a doctor who specialized in concussions on January 29, 2014, 1 week after D.A. Martin announced that they were re-examining the case. This may not have had the effect the prosecution had wanted, as the video of Snuka's match showed him as a frail old man who looked as though he was struggling just to walk. Even Judge Bannock called Snuka's behavior in the video pathetic. On June 1st, 2016, 33 years to the day that Snuka and Vince McMahon sat down with detectives in Whitehall, Judge Bannock ruled that Snuka was not mentally competent to stand trial for murder and that a new hearing would be held 6 months later to reevaluate his competency. Snuka's attorney argued that they could reevaluate him as many times as they wanted, but that his mental state was continually deteriorating, and within 6 months, he would likely be far worse than he was already. Judge Bannock added that she did not believe Snuka was faking, nor did she deem him intellectually or mentally capable of pulling off a hoax mental health issue. Snuka, though, would not make it to his next mental competency hearing. In December of 2016, the family announced that the aging wrestler had been placed in hospice care. On January 3, 2017, Judge Bannock dismissed all charges against Snuka, stating, quote, "The court is satisfied that the defendant remains incompetent, and the court is satisfied that the defendant will not regain competence, and it would be unjust to resume prosecution," end quote. Less than 2 weeks later, on January 15th, some 6 months after his initial competency hearing, Snuka died at the age of 73 as the result of terminal neurological issues. For the Argentino family, they viewed it as yet another time that Snuka was able to dodge justice, saying that they felt absolutely no closure following his death. They did, however, express that they were able to take some comfort in Snuka having to go to court in his last years. Lorraine later added, quote, "We made his life miserable his last few years. His life was affected by going to court," end quote. Snuka's death seemingly ended the possibility of pursuing any kind of official charges or ruling in the death of Nancy Argentino. The bright, friendly, and beautiful 23-year-old who died as a result of head injuries may never receive justice. And to this day, the role that Jimmy Snuka played in Nancy's death is highly debated amongst wrestling fans, as well as those who were investigating the case. The common belief is that Snuka caused the injuries that resulted in Nancy's death, but there are those who argue that Nancy may have hit her head accidentally and died later, and that if Snuka was involved in any way, it was his failure to get her medical assistance which resulted in her death. In a case like this, the aforementioned debates are really the only two theories to examine. So the first theory suggests that Nancy Argentino's death, while tragic and possibly due to Snuka's failure to get her help when needed, could have been due entirely to an accident rather than physical abuse. The second, and by far more popular theory, is that Jimmy Snuka, a man with a history of violence against women, including his own wife and Nancy herself, assaulted Nancy either on the way to Allentown or once they'd arrived at the George Washington Motor Lodge, causing her fatal injuries, which he then ignored by going to work, and eventually returned to find her unconscious and barely breathing some 12 to 24 hours after the fatal blows had been delivered. Nancy Argentino was 23 years old when she died in the company of 39-year-old Jimmy Snuka. A bright young woman with plans for the future, a caring family, and a large circle of friends, her life was cut short in a moment of brutal madness. Pulled into a world she didn't fully understand, with a man who may have been capable of things she never imagined, the young woman found herself in love with someone whom she either could not, would not, or was afraid to leave. Her death dramatically changed the lives of her family, who, to this day, are heartbroken at her loss and frustrated and angry at the failure of the legal system to act swiftly. While grateful to D.A. Martin for bringing up charges 30 years later, they will forever wonder why it took so long for those charges to be filed. For many, it's an open and shut case. Head injuries, cuts and scrapes, bruises and fractured bones. The 5 foot 7 inch 115 pound woman stood little chance against a 5 foot 10 inch 235 pound wrestler. 36 years later, despite the evidence, contradictory statements from Snuka, and the pathologist's report, the investigation into the death of Nancy Argentino is frozen and likely can never start again now that the prime and only suspect is dead.
We need to talk about something. Constipation, abdominal pain, and bloating. You tell yourself that it's not bad. You take laxatives and modify your diet and exercise routine, but thinking about it all the time is frustrating. Do you find yourself making up excuses instead of admitting to people that you don't want to go out because you're worried about leaving home? Despite your best efforts to feel better, your symptoms keep coming back. If this feels all too relatable, you are not alone. If your gut symptoms return again and again, and you don't know why, it may be time to seek help. Like 13 million others, you might have a real medical condition called irritable bowel syndrome with constipation, or IBS-C. To get more information about your symptoms and IBS-C, go to omygut.info/podcast. Learn about your constipation, abdominal pain, and bloating. And if you're ready, find out ways to talk to your doctor or access one online. That's omygut.info/podcast. omygut.info/podcast. Sponsored by Allergan and Ironwood.
The death of Nancy Argentino is a case I've known about since I was a kid. I grew up as a wrestling fan, and it was one of those stories you heard, but never in much detail. People talked about how Snuka may have killed someone, but beyond that, there wasn't much else said. When I got older and began looking into it myself, that's when I first learned about Nancy Argentino. It bothers me to this day that whenever this case comes up, people focus on Snuka and have little, if anything, to say about Nancy. To me, Nancy's life and her death are far more important than the person who may have been responsible for her dying at the young age of 23. Reading through interviews with her sisters and watching one interview with Lorraine manages to take this story, which has been spun up in rumor, speculation, whispers, and sideways comments, and turn it into something real. Oftentimes, it can be easy to read about a case or study one in a disconnected way where you're almost focused only on the story and not on the people the story is about. For more than 30 years, I've watched people write about the legacy of Jimmy Snuka. I've seen him step into a WWE ring at WrestleMania many, many years past his prime and after Nancy's death. Maybe it was something to do with the times, and in 1983, people just didn't find themselves overly concerned about what a wrestler might have done. Cut to 2007, 24 years after Nancy's death, and every television screen, newspaper, and online blog was inundated with stories accounting the harrowing final days of the Benoit family, and how Chris had murdered his wife, Nancy, and their son before taking his own life. I firmly believe that had the death of Nancy Argentino taken place 20 years later, it would have been a much bigger deal, and there's a likelihood that Snuka wouldn't have simply walked away with no charges. But the media's always had a strange relationship with professional wrestling, lauding it at times and laughing at it at others. For whatever reason, the circumstances surrounding Nancy's death got some coverage, but the main focus was on Snuka and not so much the woman who died in his company. Before moving into the two theories, I did want to address one area of this case that I undoubtedly will receive emails about, because anytime I discuss a case that involves an extramarital affair, I've got to hear from that small audience of people who have vitriol to spew about the victim. Nancy Argentino was 23 years old in a relationship with a famous man 16 years older than her who traveled the world and had money to throw around, at least for a time. Whether or not Nancy knew that Snuka was married is a topic that can be debated until the end of time, but it doesn't really matter. Whether Nancy knew or not does not make her a bad person, nor does it deem what happened to her as acceptable in any way, shape, or form. Domestic violence is a serious issue, one which has not been treated seriously throughout most of history. And remember, domestic violence can go both ways regardless of sex or gender. However, in this case, so many people seem so quick to dismiss it, which speaks volumes about the way domestic violence was viewed in the early 1980s. Thankfully, we've come a long way since then, but there are still issues with the law as pertains to this particular crime, and there are, unfortunately, still places where people will just look the other way. There's little in this world I detest more than someone who uses violence to harm or take advantage of someone who cannot defend against it. Whether that's a person who targets children, a con man targeting the elderly, or anyone who would raise a violent hand against someone they claim they love. There is much to learn about domestic violence and its impact on the victim, both physically and psychologically. Someone almost always says something like, well, why didn't she just leave? It's not that simple, and that's a line of thought that needs to be eradicated, as it speaks volumes of not only the speaker's ignorance, but society's ignorance and failure to properly address, adjudicate, and educate. Now that I've got that off my chest, let's move on to the theories. As I addressed in the evidence section of this episode, there are only two theories here, whether this was the result of an accident or if it was due to domestic abuse. Starting with the accident theory, we only have the accounts of Snuka himself to examine. Now, you can basically draw a theory out of a hat here to figure out which one you want to examine, since he was prone to giving so many. Early on, all of his stories involved him physically putting his hands on Nancy and that resulting in her head injury. Later, this story was changed to Nancy falling on the pavement along Route 22. One has to wonder how many people did Jimmy Snuka speak to on the phone between 1:50 a.m. when Nancy was pronounced dead and 9 a.m. when he sat down for his official interview with Whitehall Township Police. So what we'll do, to make this easier, is throw out all of the theories except for the one that Snuka gave to authorities and which became the story he stuck to for the rest of his life. According to Snuka, sometime between 4:30 and 5 a.m., he and Nancy stopped their purple car along Route 22 so that Nancy could relieve herself. Snuka alleges that Nancy ran into the bushes and then was making her way back when he noted that there were trucks zooming by on the road, and he advised Nancy to hurry up and get across quickly. Snuka further explained that Nancy leapt from her position on the grass onto the pavement, at which time she slipped, fell backwards, and banged her head against the pavement. Snuka at that time says he scooped her up, smacked her a few times to try and get her to come to, and then placed her in the car and drove her to the George Washington Motor Lodge. Snuka claims that when he picked Nancy up, she was conscious and spoke to him and said that her head hurt. According to Snuka, approximately 45 minutes passed between the time Nancy fell and their arrival at the Motor Lodge. Snuka then inserts parts of the story he'd never said before, where he claims that he stood Nancy up in the room, and at that time, she fell and banged her head against a chair. So now he's claiming she banged her head on the pavement and then banged her head on a chair. Also, during this interview, Snuka claims multiple times that he never hit Nancy in the past and that the closest they came was play wrestling once in a while. He also claims that anyone who said he admitted to shoving Nancy probably misunderstood him or that they were speaking so fast he couldn't understand them. So he just kept saying yes. So from that point on, Snuka's basically free to go on his own while the investigation takes place. The entire core of his story is that Nancy fell and banged her head on the pavement on Route 22, and then later fell and hit her head on a chair in the motel room. The problem with this story comes in several different areas. Firstly, Nancy's clothing was examined to find any evidence that she'd fallen outside, and there was no dirt or tears on her clothes. Secondly, no gravel or dirt was found in her hair or on her scalp during the autopsy. Thirdly, the pathologist ruled that Nancy's death was caused by her head striking a stationary object multiple times, as there was extensive damage done to suggest more than a single slip and fall. Could this have been the result of hitting her head on the pavement and then a chair? According to the pathologist, that seems unlikely, and he was quite sure Nancy's head had been banged against something multiple times in what he believed suggested mate abuse. So you've got Snuka claiming Nancy fell twice and hit her head both times. You've got the pathologist saying that her head was smashed into something multiple times. These statements don't exactly line up and leave a lot to be desired from Snuka, especially when you take into account how many different stories he had. Snuka claims in the interview that he knew Nancy had gotten a concussion when she fell on Route 22, but then he pretty much acknowledges not doing anything about it. Now, in 1983, we knew far less about concussions, and a professional wrestler who's likely been concussed before might not consider it such a major issue. But when this happens to a woman, and 12 hours later, she's still sleeping and in pain, that seems like a time where most people might think it wise to involve medical professionals, but Snuka doesn't. In fact, Snuka leaves Nancy alone in bed while he goes to work for a few hours. Snuka then claims that he was so worried about Nancy that he went to check on her. But he didn't exactly rush right back to her bedside, did he? He went to the bar with his friends, had a few drinks, and then thought it would be a good idea to check on her. When he found Nancy, he claimed that she was on the floor, barely breathing, and so he picks her up, puts her in the bed, wraps her in a sheet, and when she won't answer him, he finally decides to call 911. Now, if Nancy had hit her head sometime between 4:30 and 5 a.m., and Snuka doesn't place that 911 call until approximately 11 or 11:30 p.m., he has waited at a minimum 18 hours after the injury was sustained. It's been generally suggested that had Nancy been taken to the hospital immediately following her head trauma, she likely would have survived. I can't exactly explain what happened here that resulted in Snuka not being charged with something. I'm not going to go down the conspiratorial route that many do, accusing Snuka's boss of paying off officials, but that doesn't leave much to sort through. The district attorney allegedly felt there was not enough evidence to win a trial. Ultimately, it's his decision, and he chose not to pursue charges. It should be noted, though, that the DA did have the case thoroughly investigated, was preparing to release information to the media, and then, following the June 1st, 1983 meeting with Snuka, files no charges. Maybe the story was shaky. Maybe they doubted what evidence they did have. Even the medical examiner has said that while everything he saw suggested physical abuse leading to Nancy's injuries, he didn't have any solid proof. So the question becomes this. How likely was a jury to believe that Jimmy Snuka, a man with a violent history who's already encountered police revolving around an assault of Nancy just a few months earlier, is innocent of this crime? I don't think most prosecutors would struggle to establish Snuka's history of violence, the claims that his own wife made about him being violent with her, police statements from the night he was arrested in New York, and when pairing that up with all the different accounts he'd given to that moment, is there a jury that wouldn't suspect something more had happened here? Even in my mind, a picture speaks a thousand words, and all you have to do is see a photo of Nancy and Snuka together to see just how big he was in comparison to her. But maybe it doesn't work that way. And maybe the DA thought that Snuka's claim about the accident was enough to create reasonable doubt. Well, you're listening to this story right now. What do you think most likely happened? Is it more or less likely that Nancy Argentino slipped on the side of the road, smashed her head against the pavement, then fell in her motel room, banging her head on a chair, only to die later due to a lack of medical assistance? Or did a man with a violent history, much larger than Nancy, who had in the past physically assaulted her even in the direct view of a police officer, and who claimed to have shoved her multiple times before changing his story, possibly have done something violent to Nancy that resulted in sustaining head injuries strong enough to have ended her life? And perhaps indeed the cause of these injuries may have played a role in why Snuka never reached out for medical assistance until it was too late. This particular line of thought leads us into the second and only remaining theory, that Jimmy Snuka was directly responsible for the injuries that led to the death of Nancy Argentino. The incident in Salina, New York alone seems to speak volumes about how Snuka treated Nancy. Statements from his own wife at the time suggest that he'd been physically violent with her as well. Friend and former wrestler Buddy Rogers directly accused Snuka of violently beating his wife. Nancy's family saw what they believe were signs to indicate Snuka was physically abusing her even before the incident in Salina. One investigator reportedly made the flippant comment about how just because Snuka had beaten Nancy in the past did not mean he had beaten her to death. While that is factually accurate, it doesn't mean he didn't beat her to death either. When someone dies under suspicious circumstances, the suspect is typically their significant other or the person they were last with, which Snuka was both in this instance. So if you're like me, you're thinking, well, big guy with a violent history who's in the past beaten this woman who's now dead due to head injuries, which are inconsistent with the story he's telling, seems pretty open and shut, doesn't it? Well, I'm no lawyer, and maybe there are lawyers out there who wouldn't take on this case because they were afraid that they didn't have enough evidence to get a conviction. And I buy that as a legitimate possibility. The law doesn't work the way we often imagine, and what to a layman may seem pretty obvious, in the eyes of the law may be far more complicated. Much of that may hold true, but then there's a major issue here. They successfully got a grand jury to indict Snuka 30 years later, based on the same evidence, testimony, and witnesses that they had in 1983. A grand jury, for those of you who don't know, doesn't work the same as a jury in a criminal trial. With a grand jury, a prosecutor will provide evidence and work with the grand jury to try and establish whether or not there's enough evidence to present and charge someone with a crime. In this grand jury, the prosecutor, District Attorney Martin, provided documents relating to the investigation of 1983. Snuka spoke to the grand jury, but by this time claimed he couldn't remember anything due to deteriorating brain function. The grand jury didn't take an exceptionally long time to conclude that an indictment should follow. Why is it that 30-year-old evidence somehow carried more value than it did when it was new evidence? This case doesn't feel that dense. It's not like you have witnesses placing Snuka elsewhere. It's not as though Snuka outright denied any involvement. You have multiple people that he told he shoved Nancy and then she fell and hit her head on the concrete. He doesn't change his story until hours later, and reading through the transcript of his interview with investigators, it seems rather clear based on their line of questioning that they had a lot of doubts about what Snuka was telling them. Multiple times in the transcript, an officer has to stop Snuka, ask him to go back and re-explain something that he failed to tell them about before. They go back to the incident on the side of Route 22 several times as Snuka continually adds in details that he had never mentioned before. I wasn't standing there when Snuka spoke. I don't know how his voice sounded or how he behaved. We may have one of those answers if the tape of that interview hadn't been lost, but we don't have it. We can only go on what we know for a fact. Laying the facts out seems pretty clear. Man who had assaulted woman before claims that head injuries the woman suffered leading to her death were caused by a fall and not his own hands. Snuka claims multiple times in the interview and in interviews with newspapers, in conversations with friends, that he'd never put his hands on Nancy in that way, yet we have direct testimony from an Onondaga sheriff's deputy that Snuka grabbed a handful of Nancy's hair, pressed her face into a wall, and then threw her back into their hotel room. Just how credible do you think the statements of Jimmy Snuka are? A lot of people are going to ask me why I covered this case, because the answer seems so obvious. Well, that's a big part of why I covered this case. Nancy's story is often dismissed as people just casually remark, oh, Snuka probably killed her. Like it's no big deal. Like it's not a horrifying crime likely committed by a man who then got to live out his life, earn money, travel the world, get inducted into the Hall of Fame and appear on future WrestleManias, while Nancy's family has only a plain grave in Greenwood Cemetery to visit and spend time with their lost sister and lost daughter. They will always wonder what Nancy could have been if she could only have gotten away from the man they firmly believe ended her life. It's really rare that I give you too much of what my direct opinion is about a case, and to this moment I'm debating whether or not this section of the audio will make it into the final episode. But when it comes to the death of Nancy Argentino, there's never been anything to convince me that this was anything less than a murder. Having looked at the evidence, read the transcripts, the autopsy report, studied countless interviews with detectives, medical staff, friends, and family, the obviousness of what likely occurred here is difficult to miss. Were someone to put a gun to my head and ask me what I believed happened here, I'd have no choice but to say, I don't believe it was an accident. But what I really want to know is, what do you think? Do you believe if you were sitting on a jury and had this case before you, that there's enough here to convince you that it was murder, or do you believe there's reasonable doubt? Nancy Argentino died more than 36 years ago. If alive today, she would be 59. What would she have been? A mother? A grandmother? An aunt? Whatever path Nancy may have been able to take was forever eliminated as an option when she was left in pain, slowly dying, in a motel room outside of Allentown, Pennsylvania. Jimmy Snuka lived to the age of 73, and while his last years were plagued with health issues and courtroom drama, for the most part, he continued right along after 1983. He partied, hung out with his friends, wrestled, established a bigger name for himself, and got to do things his way. On October 17, 1983, 4 months after Nancy died, Snuka leapt into history when he climbed to the top of a steel cage and dove down onto Don Morocco. That image is iconic. That footage has been shown countless times. I just pulled it up on WWE.com simply by typing Snuka Cage Morocco. How many people have seen it and are aware that just 4 months earlier, Snuka's girlfriend died after sustaining horrible injuries to her skull? How many knew about the implications of how Nancy may have received those injuries? How many cared? There's this debate today about, can you separate the artist from their art? I think it's a case-by-case basis. But when you really look at Snuka and realize that the height of his stardom and the legacy of his career was truly established after Nancy's death, that's just never sat right with me. So we're likely never going to get an answer to this mystery one way or the other. Many of you by this point likely believe that you already know what happened. The Argentino family believes they knew exactly what happened the moment they found out that Nancy was dead. They lived with that pain for 30 years before charges were finally filed, and now that Snuka is gone and the charges have been dropped, we join the Argentino family in the chaotic limbo of the unknown, believing that we know the truth, but also being aware that we will never see justice done. The death of Nancy Argentino remains a horrifying story of love, loss, pain, and violence. Perhaps now Nancy might have the opportunity to be remembered for the person she was, the person she could have been, rather than the spotlight always focusing on the man who many believe took her life. If you're looking for more information about the death of Nancy Argentino, many online forums discuss her case. Many news articles are available, and the Morning Call newspaper has a comprehensive series digging into every detail and facet of this case. There are also documentaries available online, as well as books that have been written about it. If you have any information about the death of Nancy Argentino, please contact the Lehigh County District Attorney's Office or the FBI. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod. Email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com, Instagram message me at traceevidencepod, or comment in the Facebook group. I'm going to play a promo for you from an amazing true crime podcast called The Minds of Madness. You should definitely give them a listen, and make sure to stick around after the promo for details regarding a contest that could make you a part of Trace Evidence.
911, what's your emergency?
Every 60 seconds, a person is murdered somewhere in the world.
There was a shootout at my house. I can't believe it.
What causes ordinary people to do unthinkable things?
He stabbed me in my neck. And he says, look how easily I could kill you.
The Minds of Madness is a true crime podcast that examines the most disturbing criminal minds. We shed a light on the devastating impact these violent crimes have on the victims and their families.
When you get calls in the night, you know they're not good or they're wrong numbers.
You'll hear about the incredible strength of the survivors and what they did to fight back.
I was studying his face because I was thinking, if I get out of this, I'm going to get you someday.
Subscribe to the Minds of Madness podcast today on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Play.
So So you've just heard a podcast promo, and that's what this contest is all about. Every year, I record a new promo to advertise Trace Evidence. And this year, rather than doing all the talking myself, I wanted to get you involved. What would you say to convince a friend to listen to Trace Evidence? What is it about Trace Evidence that you like? Write yourself a little script, record it, and send it to me. You can email me the audio file at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Or if you don't have the setup to record, you can leave a voicemail at 770-744-5104. Winners will have their clip inserted into the promo and will receive some Trace Evidence gear. For full contest details and information, visit trace-evidence.com/promo. I look forward to hearing from you. A special shout out and thank you to Trace Evidence Patreon producers Alicia Lorraine, Krista Colvin, Deani Dyson, Eamon Brady, Emily Smith, Julia Rexon, Kate Alexander, Megan, Randy Weiland, Chandra Moreau, Tara Doble, Megan Cotter, and Tom Archer. Trace Evidence wouldn't be possible without the kindness of all of you amazing listeners. Visit patreon.com/traceevidence for more information. I want to thank you for listening to this episode of Trace Evidence and remind you that I'll be taking next week, the 15th, off. So we'll be back on July 22nd with another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.